Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence, and by Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 93 for Thursday, March 3rd, 2011. Whatever you do, don't say museum. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autolinedetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern or 2400 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline After Hours in the iTunes Store. Well, it's great to be back in the studio here, as we do every week for Autoline After Hours. And joining me, as always, is the auto extremist.
Hey, John.
Peter, great having you here.
Good to be here.
And also joining us this evening is Mark Gillies. Mark, great having you here, too.
Good to be here, yeah.
And so who do we tell our audience that you're working for these days? What are you up to?
I'm doing this and that, really. I'm doing some work for automotive design and production. I've been doing a bit of work for Gene Jennings over at Automobile Magazine. Just this and that bit of work for Evo Magazine in the UK. So it's all good fun, actually, yeah.
Cool. Good to hear it. And joining us later in the show, too, we're going to have David Madeira, the president of the LeMay Museum. This, I think it's going to be, we'll get him to talk about it when he comes on, the biggest public car museum in the world when they get this thing done. And it's being built in Tacoma, Washington, and we're going to have to get the story behind all that, too. But Peter, you were in the news this week because you've got your new book that's almost coming out.
I was, yes, briefly.
Well, you've got...
It's out.
It's out right now?
Yeah, it is out.
Witch Hunt is the name of it.
Yes.
And what's the subtitle again? You can't even remember your own subtitle.
Yeah, I can. essays on the... automobile industry and the blithering idiots who almost killed it.
And
it's basically, it's the run-up to the bankruptcies. It's that whole time, and it's after. It's kind of a two-and-a-half-year period where Detroit imploded, and it's the best of my essays from Auto Extremist. Plus, there's new stuff in it. There's new setups to each column so people can actually understand my frame of mind when I wrote that particular column, which I think people who've read it find it interesting.
Yeah, and
it's got a great cover.
What's the cover?
Well, Ben can. It's a red cover, almost like 50s style, with the Washington Capitol and a guy with a pitchfork, and it's good.
Well, I say that
there
you,
it is,
oh, there
right
it is,
there.
Up on the screen here, yeah. Yeah, that is a good cover. I like that. And I say that you were in the news because WWJ here in Detroit, which is the CBS All News affiliate that I also do reports
on.
That
you appear on, yes.
Right. They did an interview with you, and
Roberta Giacina interviewed me, and then I forgot about it. And then you emailed me and said, "Hey, did you?"
Yeah, you're all over the radio this morning, right?
I'm like, huh? No, I didn't hear it.
The other thing that's funny too is the publisher contacted me, and they shot me in an email and said, "Oh, there's this new book out, and we can get you a copy. Would you like one?" So I shot it back and said, "Yeah, I'd love to get a copy." So they shot back another email and said, "You know, we can arrange for you to interview Peter DeLorenzo."
Was that Susanna?
It was a woman, so yeah. I didn't pay attention to the name. So.
Susanna from New York, yeah. That's funny. That's really funny.
So, Mark, you just jetted back from Europe. You were at the Geneva Motor Show.
Yeah, it was pretty interesting. It was. I actually met a mate of mine at about 5 o'clock on Tuesday, which was the first press day, and he went, "I don't think I've seen everything," and I think that's the first auto show I've been to for ages, where you were just amazed by how many concepts and new cars there were. And, you know, there were quite a few real cars on the show floor, so it looks like there's a bit of confidence coming back at long last.
Well, that's good to hear.
So what did you like?
Yeah.
I really liked there was a little Alfa sports car, the 4C, which looks like a baby HC Competizione.
And the pictures, to me, it looked ungainly. Does it look better?
It was really pretty. It was really nicely done. But they're saying that it's going to be mid-50s.
Price, you mean, $50,000.
Yeah, they said 60 in the U.S.
Yeah, they were talking 50s in Europe. And so it's based on a KTM Expo underneath. You know, that very ungainly looking track special.
Track car, yeah.
But it's got a 1750cc Alpha engine, making 200 horsepower, mounted at the back. And I think everybody was really shocked to see it. A couple of Chrysler guys I knew were like, oh, we didn't know that one was coming. The VW Bully, which is a really daft name for anywhere in the English-speaking world, that was kind of neat. It looks like a little bit like the microbus they showed at Detroit, about 2002, I think it was?
Yeah. Only smaller, right?
It's smaller. Mm. It's based on a Polo, and they're almost certainly going to do it. And I thought that was terrific. That was really nice.
Now, the one they showed at the show was electric, no?
But they also said they're going to have four-cylinder engines in it.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be based off Golf Passat.
It's electric, and, you know.
Yeah.
They're always doing that.
But I found it interesting that it does evolve out of that earlier minivan that they showed in Detroit a decade ago.
Yeah, well, that one, I mean, that thing would never have been able to crash if you look where, you know, the occupants were relative to the front end of the car. But this one looked like a production feasible.
I hear what you're saying, but I'm just saying that the styling theme, the form language, is very much an evolution out of that earlier one.
Yeah, there were some people saying that wasn't the case, but I think they were smoking something.
Oh.
Or not.
Well, not the case, maybe. There was a really nice Nissan concept, the S-Flow, which was a pure pie-in-the-sky sports car, but it showed what you can do with the Leaf running gear. And then, of course, there was a new Lamborghini and a new Ferrari, and that's... The Lambo is a bit boring, I thought. I mean, we've seen it before, but the Ferrari was, you know, a Ferrari station wagon with all-wheel drive. But it looked not very good in the photos, but when you saw it in the flesh, it was pretty dramatic. I'm not sure it's going to sell that well, but it was very dramatic.
Well, they won't make very many, so they'll probably sell it.
Sell everyone they make.
They'll sell as many as they need to.
Yeah.
But it was neat. The Lamborghini was interesting because it's a carbon fiber monocoque. And, you know, very clever under the skin. But, you know, one of my colleagues was waxing lyrical about the side strakes. And I said, if you're waxing lyrical about the side strakes, they've dropped the plot. Because, you know, when I was a 13-year-old kid and the Countach came out, it was just like another world. And even when you saw the Diablo for the first time, it was pretty rocking. And this thing was like, eh. It didn't
just seemed like yet another thing from them, that more of the same. How was the Saab concept?
It was cool, actually. Yeah. And, of course, the new chief designer was at Pininfarina. So it was really nicely done.
Those little winglet things coming off.
I don't know. That was pure, the thing was pure fantasy. I mean, they're not going to build it. But, again, it's the deal where they're saying this is showing styling.
Well, they said it's going to influence the next 9.3. Yeah, I believe that when I see it.
Well, I'll believe it when a new 9.3 comes along.
Yeah.
That's more fundamental. Well, some wag pointed out that Phoenix, it might be going the other way. That was the name of the concept.
That's pretty good.
But there were lots of very, very interesting cars. I mean, there was the weirdest thing to me probably was the electric Rolls-Royce with about 1,000 pounds of battery up front.
So it's what, about an 8,000-pound car then?
Nah, 6,200, something like that. But it was they say it's the biggest battery. You know, the Phantom's an enormous car, and basically the battery just took up where the transmission and the engine was. But that, again, they were just floating boats with that, going to show it to customers and see if they're going to build it or not.
But you got to believe that at some point they're going to have to consider that, especially in Europe with certain city centers barring internal combustion engines. And unless you have an electric, you're not going to be able to take a car in there.
Well, it was also interesting because I spoke to one of the engineers, and he said, you know, we've got customers who've got 5 or 6 cars, and they'll just use the Rolls to go to the opera. You know, they might live in, I don't know, Munich or London or somewhere like that. They'll keep the car in the garage, just bring it out for special occasions, and it might never leave a city. So at that point, you know, they can show off and be environmentally friendly, well, sort of environmentally friendly.
Mm-hmm.
So it was interesting. I mean, just, you know, the scale of the thing was pretty impressive.
What was the buzz at the show? What were people talking about?
I think people were, you know, the buzz was that people were showing cars again, and the industry looked to have, you know, some signs of life. I think that was the main thing. There was a bit of buzz about the Lancia Chryslers on the show floor. The idea of rebadging a 200 sedan and convertible as Lancia Flavias, you know, I think there are Lancia fans just turning, you know, in their graves at the
moment. As my Texas friends would say, that dog won't hunt even with the T-bone. I mean, that's just bullshit. That's just, I'm sorry, it's...
I don't see it working.
It's not going to work.
I don't know, the 300 as a Lancia Tamer has some kind of legs, maybe, but Lancias were always about clever engineering, and they were, except for some of the cars in the 30s, they were always smallish cars, you know, the great cars like the Aurelia and the Fulvia and the Flaminia, they weren't big cars. It was only the cars in the 30s. You know, if there's a link between Chrysler and Lancia, you know, where at any point in their lives that they've crossed, it was in the 30s when you had these beautiful, you know, LeBaron-bodied Chrysler Imperials, and you had things like Lancia Dilambdas. But, you know, I don't think anybody thinks of either manufacturer as being, you know, full-on luxury car makers anymore. And that's the only time that they've had any kind of, you know, parity in their whole histories. It's very strange.
Well, you know, I think it's going to help Chrysler more than Lancia. I don't see this really saving Lancia. It's a brand that loses money. I don't see it growing. If Chrysler can get a little bit more volume for its plants, okay, that's good. But I don't really see it.
Anyone over there buying a 200 Chrysler 200 rebadges. I just don't see it.
No, it's not. It doesn't exactly strike me as genius, but we'll see.
Anything else that you can think of that stood out at the Geneva show?
Well, I thought it interesting. Some of the BMW stuff was just weird. And, you know, you look at BMW and Honda, and you look at two car companies that, you know, enthusiasts love because they make great driving cars, and they're all over the map at the moment. And the other thing I think that stood out was Mercedes styling is just awful at the moment. The new SLK is dog-like, and
they've just lost it.
They've revamped, you know, the C-Class Coupe. I look at it and go, It's very strange, you know. You contrast and compare that to Audi, and Audi had an RS3.
Yeah, that was sweet.
And what was really sweet was that they had Michel Mouton and Michel Mouton's incredibly gorgeous daughter driving it onto the stage.
Now you're talking.
And they also showed an A3 quotes unquote concept, and it's a sedan. And I think, you know, Johan Denisson has pushed very hard to get a sedan version to the States. And you look at the Audi styling and, you know, the way those cars are presented, and then you look at what BMW is doing at the moment, and you go, you know, there's something going wrong there, you know.
Well, that's why I think Audi's now outselling BMW in Europe, why it's the fastest growing luxury brand in the world. And as you know, here in the U.S., we just got the February sales, and of all the Cadillac had a blowout month. We should talk about that, too. But of the German makes, I mean, Audi's growth, even though they're far behind in sales, they're growing faster by far than BMW or Mercedes.
Yeah, and it's funny. It's sort of the age-old thing. If you've got the products, eventually people will come round to it. I always think, you know, having lived here for 16 years, you know, Americans are actually a lot more status symbol, more aware of status symbols and slightly snobbish about things. You know, the Mercedes badge still has an enormous clout here, and Audi. But Audi's always had a little bit of an issue because I think, you know, obviously the unintended acceleration thing, but it's not, until recently, been a smart thing to buy. It doesn't say, I've got a ton of money. But now you've had things like the Q7 and, you know, the particularly the R8 out there. I think people think that there's some real cachet to the brand. And it's interesting because, I mean, I'd prefer driving a 7 Series to an A8 in some ways. But as a luxury car package, you know, it's pretty darn good. And, you know, it looks terrific as well. And the new A6 is darn good, too, so...
So, Peter, what did you make of the sales here, especially, you know, sticking with luxury for a minute? Cadillac had a blowout month. I mean, something like a 70% increase in sales.
But didn't we had Mark Rice as a guest for Outline.
Well, we should, yeah, we were.
The Sunday show, which won't be shown for a month.
Yeah, it's a couple of weeks away, 3 weeks away. But, yeah, Mark Rice was in the studio here yesterday, too.
I thought that they were putting a lot of money on Cadillacs to do that.
Well, I mean, you know, what all the analysts are saying is General Motors and Toyota spent more on incentives this last month, I mean, and they both had blowout months.
Yeah, the public pronouncements are that General Motors, oh, we're smart about it, we're targeting it, we're not doing it the old way. The reality in the trenches is another thing. And you know,
so you're saying they're actually spending more money than what they're fessing up to.
Yes, because that's the reality of the market. And also, I don't think Lieutenant Dan Akerson and Chris Liddell, who's the CFO, have ever been through this where they start one of these incentive binges. They've never seen the end game of that.
The old regime got caught up in that.
The old regime.
Look what happened to them.
The old Detroit got caught up in that.
Right.
Yeah.
If you recall, that whole thing started right after 9/11, when GM did the famous campaign, Let's Get America Rolling Again. And it was brilliant at the time. The problem is when January came along the following year, GM should have said, okay, we're going to pull the plug on that. Instead, they decided, well, wait a minute. And this is a marketing strategy now, incentives. And Detroit never recovered from it. So in this go-around, you know, GM is saying one thing. The reality in the trenches seems to be a little different. I don't think Akerson or Liddell have never, obviously, they've never experienced what this does. It sets off a whole bunch of things, and we've all seen that movie before, and it doesn't end well.
So Ford had like a 12% increase in sales, which is good. Sales were up. But the market grew at 27%, so Ford's losing market share.
Yeah.
Is Ford going to be pressured into following suit?
They've already put some incentives on their trucks that weren't there.
That's not a good sign.
No.
Which is a shame, actually, because if you can keep growing at 10, 12% without throwing money on the hood, that's actually a better business case.
Sure, it is. Well, it's very sustainable.
Yeah, and the whole point of Detroit getting off the mat again is, okay, keep inventories low, you have better product, keep the transaction, average transaction prices is the key. They've all been trending up. Now, you know, GM has started to dabble in this thing, and I just think it's a horrible mistake. It's a bad way to go.
It's a bad way to go because we should talk this full circle or all the way through, because when you start discounting your cars, that means somebody coming in to trade in their used car suddenly finds it's not worth as much because the new one's been discounted. So that means the old one's discounted, which means they need more incentive to get more money for other trade-in, and it's a death spiral.
Yeah, and where Detroit got their asses handed to them by the imports was the fact that the residual values of the imports were impeccable, better, dramatically better. And now Detroit's got some, you know, worthy products, and here's their chance. You know, bring the resales up. You know, average transaction prices up. Make money.
Right.
Man, that's just a...
What a concept. Make money. Yeah. But the good news is, I think, probably GM and Toyota were the ones really guilty of the incentives. I think the good news is the whole market was up and up strong.
Yeah.
27%. That's a huge pop.
But I look at some of the stuff. I look at the lease price on a Sonata at $199 a month, and I'm going, hang on a sec. That seems like that's an incentive by the back door to me. And I, you know, you see around Detroit some of the lease prices on Chrysler products, and they're insane. I mean, how can you make money at $179 a month on a Caravan or something like that? I don't see that.
No, I agree. You can't make money at that. And the Sonata one's interesting. I'd like to look into that. Their residuals have come up a lot, and as your residuals come up, it will lower your lease price. But what's interesting to me is that the Sonata had a good month, but not a great month. And in fact, if you look at all passenger cars, it just barely broke into the top 10. So in that regard, I think it lost some momentum. Still up in sales, but not up as much as the competition was up.
Yeah, and you look at, I mean, the GM one to me was, you know, it was ridiculous numbers, but it could be partly because they've got some new product out there. When you've got things like Cruise out there, you know, Equinox is doing great. You've got the Regal. I can't remember what the Buick number was, but it was insane. I mean, but then, you know, you go from two or three vehicles to four or five, you suddenly are going to go up by.
That's right. You put more cars in the showroom, you're bound to sell more cars.
Gosh, there's a shock, you know.
Right. So I'm encouraged, though, because to see the entire market jump that much in 1 month's time, and January wasn't a bad month either, shows me that the increase in fuel prices has not, at least not yet, had an effect on sales. And it really hasn't even had much of an effect on what people are buying because, again, small cars lost market share. Even though they were up double digits, they were not up as much as the entire market.
It's got to go. It's got to go to $4 a gallon in this part of the world.
Which everyone's talking about it happening.
Well, or $5 in California. And if that happens, then people will start to get out of the bigger cars. I mean, the thing that did my head in the last time gas went to ridiculous prices was people were, you know, ditching their trucks or talking about ditching their trucks and buying small cars.
Yeah, they were taking, you know, $11,000-$12,000 hits.
To save nothing.
Yeah.
you know, to save $1,500 a year or less, they were going to take a $10,000 hit. And that, to me, was, you know, completely insane thinking.
And I think that people are much smarter this go-around. That was 3 years ago, coming up on 3 years ago. I think people are smarter, but there is a limit, you know. Over $4, and if it stays there, we'll see.
Hey, we got to take a quick break here to acknowledge one of our great sponsors, Chevrolet. You can check out the new Chevrolet Cruze at chevrolet.com/cruise. And I keep joking that, you know, ever since they started sponsoring this show, their sales have taken off. Of course, there's a couple of other reasons why it's doing. You get all kinds of stuff like remote start from your MyLink app, 9-speaker Pioneer premium sound system, XM satellite radio, USB port to plug in your iPod, 40-gig hard drive in the LTZ model, OnStar turn-by-turn directions for the first 6 months for free, and a whole bunch of other stuff. So check it out at chevrolet.com/cruise. And, of course, in this case, Cruise is C-R-U-Z-E. So we mentioned earlier in the program we were going to have this guy named David Madeira join us, and maybe this would be a good time to bring him in. Ben, let's get David in the studio with us via Skype here. And just so you folks know, Dave Madeira is the president of the LeMay Museum, and he's up on the screen with us here. David, how you doing?
Great. Thank you for having me. It's good to be with you guys.
You bet. So all I know about the LeMay Museum is that you're building this gigantic museum in Tacoma, Washington. And I guess my first question is, why Tacoma? I mean, you guys are next door to Boeing. I could understand if it's an aerospace museum, but how did a car museum end up in Tacoma, Washington?
Well, it's a great question, and it's an easy answer. The gentleman by the name of Harold LeMay lived out here in Tacoma area. He quintessential American success story, raised in poverty, went off to World War II, came back, no education, didn't know what to do, started hauling trash, turned it into a $100 million a year business, and started buying cars. And by the time he died in 2000, he had 3,000 automobiles back to 1903 out here in Tacoma, Washington.
So what's in his collection? What can you tell us about it?
Well, he was not a connoisseur. Nancy, his widow, would tell you that he never met a car that he didn't like. And he was this American guy who, you know, wandered all around the country, and he'd just buy stuff. So his collection is largely American, date back to 1903. Everything from utility trucks of all kinds to, electric vehicles to Duesenbergs and Franklins and, Corvettes and muscle cars. I mean, in one word, I would tell you it's the Smithsonian of the automobile.
So he passed away, and yep. there's this big collection of cars that's sitting around, and then what? Somebody decided, hey, we ought to have put all this in a museum?
He had a good attorney who had told him shortly before he died that he would lose his collection, you know, through poor estate planning, like Hara. And so he did take the step of creating a not-for-profit back in 1997. And they didn't do anything with it, but he had protected it that way. Then he passed on, and his widow and a few business leaders from Tacoma said, well, let's start an effort to create a museum and preserve this collection. And that's really when the effort got started. And I was brought in the summer of 2002 to develop the plans to build this museum.
I noticed that you've been selling some cars off recently in auctions. I mean, is that to raise funds or is that just to make sure you can actually house the cars? Because, I mean, 3,000 is a ridiculous amount.
Absolutely, Mark. The you know, Harold had cars. In fact, if any of you are ever out, because there's still some of it around, and I'd be happy to show you, because it's something everybody ought to see once in their lifetime. He had cars stuffed in barns all over the place. At the home, he had 300 cars in barns at their five-bedroom house, you know, and they were stacked up. And then he bought a military academy. There are cars in the shower room and the gym. He had 200 Chevrolets in a gymnasium, and he had cars up in the bleachers. And Mark, is what you're getting at. And there were cars out in fields under tarps, you know, and sheds. And so what you're getting at is really very point on. You can't take care of a collection like that. And so I began to work with the family about, let's pare this down, that the only way you're really going to save the collection is if indeed you pare it down. And so they've sold off about 1,500 cars over the last 7 years. And our permanent collection will be about 700 cars, which is still, you know, a huge number. But that was the primary motivation, is to make it more manageable.
And what are you deciding to keep as the focus of the 700 cars that you've got left?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
What are you deciding to keep as like the focus of the 700 or so cars you're keeping?
Well, it's an ongoing process. We've got a pretty good good collection, but our theme really is for the museum is celebrating America's love affair with a car. So it doesn't mean American cars only, but what we really want to try to achieve is have a collection that shows vehicles that Americans were part of the American experience and Americans loved. So they may be cars from the British invasion. You know, my first car was a TR3. So it might be vehicles like that, and not be limited to American cars only. But what might have been the experience here? We just sold last year a beautiful Daimler, 39 Daimler, Green Goddess. And it was a gorgeous car, but, you know, it didn't fit. And we sold that, used it to raise money, but... No one or very few people would have thought of that as part of the American experience.
So you're building this big museum out there, David, and you guys sent us some pictures. Ben, we ought to get them up on the screen. It looks to me like you're really trying to make an architectural statement with this. Talk a little bit about what the building itself is going to be like and what all it's going to house.
We realized that we didn't know a whole lot when we started. I didn't come out of the car industry. I mean, like most Americans my age, boys growing up in the 50s and all, I loved cars, but I didn't have a lifetime in it. So we went around and we looked at museums all over the world to see what would work and what wouldn't work. We found that most in America don't function very well. They'll set up a collection and that's it. You go once or you go twice. And you don't need to go again, and they're dead. And so we actually found more life in many of the European museums, and took some influence there. And then we began to look at tourist attractions and say, you know, what we really need to do is create a destination that car activity can and enthusiast activity can take place. So we have a 3.5-acre show field. I wish it were bigger. But for me, that may be one of the most important parts of what we're doing, because we want to have all kinds of car events taking place on a regular basis, new car and old car, you know, enthusiast clubs, et cetera. But when we built the building, we wanted it to reflect a modern reflection. That I don't even like the word museum, you know, and I don't want to go experience because it's trite. But we don't want to be stuck in the past. So we wanted a building that's modern. We wanted it to have automotive lines, and, you know, people can look at that shape, and from some angles it might strike you as a quarter panel on the rear of a car, and others say it's kind of a hood scoop, you know, reminiscent of the 60s or something. But we wanted automotive design. We built it with a roadway in it. There's the four floors are connected with a 1/3-mile long road, so that you're actually moving through the museum. And we wanted that sense of motion in what we were building as well. I don't know if that answered your question.
Yeah, it does. It does. You mentioned you just don't want it to be a place that you go to once or twice. You picked up some things from European museums and other tourist destinations. Give us some examples. What are you talking about of having more than just cars there?
Well, one of the things we decided to do is to be a very active museum. So we have, for example, a club facility up in Seattle. We have another one in Denver. We have a facility in a partnership in San Jose. We're looking at Scottsdale and Chicago and Orlando right now. And the notion is we want people to be able to belong to America's Car Museum and enjoy the activities that we will do in different parts of the country. So these facilities are places where we will have events tours and day drives and coffee cruise-ins, and where members can store their cars and move them around between locations. So we're trying to be active and supportive of the car clubs and the culture that way. You think of all the guys who have their car and they use store it places, and they go out there by themselves. They roll up the door and they wipe the car down and they put it away and they're sad. And we want to engage them with others. So that's one piece. We promote events. The Pebble Beach Motoring Classic, we sponsor every year and help operate the 8-day trip from here to Monterey in vintage cars. We're participating in the Mille Miglia with our 27 LaSalle this year. And our board member, Nicola Bulgari, is going to do some events over there in Italy for us to promote things. We participate in the New York Auto Show every year. This year we're doing a feature on mini and micro cars. And instead of just bringing our own, we invite people to bring their cars and do people's choice kind of stuff. We've been Rod Albert's there in Detroit's on our advisory board, and we've done some things with him at the North American International Auto Show. So we're trying to reach into different venues and promote activity. Then on site, we also will develop educational programs for kids, the traditional museum stuff. We collaborate with some colleges on internships for young people to learn professions, you know, related to restoration, preservation of cars, those kinds of activities.
So I know early on you had some of the automakers supporting you. Is that still the case?
Yeah, you know, they came in. Bob Lutz came in right away. I went to visit him. It was kind of embarrassing. I had a self-published magazine, and I went to see him. He was kind enough to see me, but I was smart enough to bring our list of 600 General Motors cars, 150 Cadillacs, and he just went through them, you know. And so he became the first guy back in Detroit to say, I get what this is all about and want to help you. And so he brought Ed Welburn onto our board and got Scott Keller on board with us, who now works for me, and you know Scott. I blanked on your question.
Well, I think you answered it. You know, you still have support from some of the car companies then.
We do. When the downturn hit and bankruptcy hit GM, we lost some of that support for a while. But now there's more energy. We're talking to Ford about some things related to our grand opening. Jim Farley and I have had conversation about the heritage of the Mustang and things we might do there. I'm even going to be at Nissan next week. They're interested in doing some stuff around the Leaf, and that's another point. We don't want to be stuck in the past. We want to be a venue where new cars and concept cars are shown, and dealer events take place, and product rollouts. And we want to talk about where we're going, not just where we've been.
And I see that you've got my pal and colleague Ken Gross coming in as what you're. Curator, but only just to get it launched or something like that, right?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I have great respect for Ken. He's a storyteller. And we thought, Scott Keller and I, when we were talking about how do we want to do the first exhibit, actually Scott said, you know, it's all about storytelling. Let's get a journalist. And then I happened to be riding in the Pebble Beach Motoring Classic with Ken in a Bentley last summer, and we had about 8 hours together, and we just started talking. And I said, well, why don't you come in as the first curator? And so we will launch with a theme about America celebrating the automobile and what that means and all of its eclectic nature. And it should be fun. I'm excited to have him on board.
That's cool. Well, this is great to hear. Say, I think we ought to get to the rapid-fire part. So, David, stick around, because I'm sure you're going to get some questions. Before we jump into that, though, we've got to thank our other sponsor here tonight, Bridgestone. You can check them out at bridgestonetire.com. They've got their third-generation run-flat tires with groundbreaking new technology. And, of course, for automakers in particular, not just consumers, they ought to check into this run flat tire technology that Bridgestone has got. And whether you're just a regular everyday consumer or if you happen to be one of the engineers at any of the car companies, check it out at bridgestonetire.com. And so, Ben, let's get into rapid fire here. Bring in the music and the graphic. Okay, our first question comes from Brian, and he says, Peter, is your book going to be available on the iTunes bookstore? I would love to read it on my iPad.
Yeah, eventually it will be. My publisher assures me there's going to be digital ways to read it. So,
Youngblood from Cleveland, I think, Mark, this one's for you. What'd you think of the Mini Rocket Man, and is it coming to the U.S.?
It's very odd. Mini is like, I don't know, again, it's another BMW thing, is how many Minis can you have? I thought that one was actually quite nicely proportioned. There's something really weird about what they're doing at the moment. It looked like a shortened Clubman. It was a three-door Clubman-type thing. But, you know, the Countryman, the rather large, ungainly thing, is completely clueless, if you ask me. I mean,
which they're using for their WRC car, which...
It says Mini, M-I-N-I. It means small. It doesn't mean kind of big and clunky and horrible. So the Rocket Man was like one of the best concepts they've done recently, but it still sort of sucked to me. Anyway, what do I know?
Okay. Dragonfire has two questions. He says, I read somewhere that Ford was getting into the hydraulic hybrid. Were they not supposed to be making one with the EPA a few years back? They tested one with the EPA. They never committed to production. Mm-hmm. Now the latest on that is Sergio Marchionne went to the EPA lab, and they're talking about building a hydraulic hybrid version for the Dodge Caravan. I don't know if anything's going to go of that. He also goes on to say Dragonfire does. They also stated it would get 40 miles per gallon on the highway. Is that even possible without a total redesign? I don't know. We're going to have to we need to get somebody from the EPA on the show and talk about this hydraulic hybrid. Yeah. They've been hawking this thing for some time. Mud Monster wants to know, did somebody put the couch on Craigslist? No, we took the couch out of the studio here because we have David being Skyped in on a screen, and so everybody could watch him on Skype. We took the couch out. So, no, we have not put it on Craigslist yet. Steve wants to know, so which do you think is better, the Chevy Cruze, the 2011 Hyundai Elantra, or the 2012 Ford Focus? Which would you buy with your money? Peter, I know your answer.
Well, that's gonna be the mainstream in the trenches battle in the U.S. market this year and going forward.
Elantra, Focus, Cruze.
Right. I would...
Of course, the Elantra's a little bit smaller than those.
Yeah,
things.
Yeah. I would err towards the Focus myself.
Mark, what do you think?
Focus. The Cruze is, it's a nice vehicle, but, you know, what you have to remember is that in Europe, the Chevy Cruze is actually a cheaper car than the Focus. It doesn't, you know, Opel has the Astra that competes with the Focus, and the Cruze is a lower-priced, lesser vehicle in most ways, and it drives pretty well, but it's not great. And the Elantra, I just had one, and I was pretty shocked by how average it was. And by the way, did anybody sit in the back before it got into production? Because it's got no headroom, you know? And it's a nice enough car. It's a nice interior, looks great, but very disappointing to drive to me.
I haven't driven the Elantra yet. I can't wait to. But if you just look at the spec list and the price, it's pretty compelling.
Oh, it's great. I mean, in terms of the way, you know, the interior is great, as I say, and exterior is great. And it drives okay, but it's not, you know, a Focus is a much better driving vehicle.
Plus, it's a design statement, I think.
Yeah.
I think you're right.
007 Mitch W. says, now that's a happening shirt on John McElroy. Please praise. DC Auto Geek wants to know, David, what will the entry fee be to the LeMay Museum? Or LeMay, I'll try not to use that word, museum.
Yeah, thanks. $15 for a day's visit. Members, of course, are free anytime they come in, and a basic membership is $50 a year.
Good to know. Hey, Ben, let's bring in that phone call. There was one actually last week from Bob Hall, Jim Hall's brother, in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. And the call came in too late for the show, but I think it still might be pertinent to use. Let's bring that one in.
Hi. This is Bob Hall calling from Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. What the hell is DiLorenzo talking about? Doesn't he know who Rocket Man is? Everybody knows Rocket Man is Jeff King. Just ask Jimmy. He'll tell you. It is Jeff King. Great show. Bye.
Do you know what he's talking about?
No. I only know one Rocket Man. That's Rick Mears on the ovals in his heyday.
Ray Schaffer would like to know, David, he wants your thoughts on what makes a great collector car. For example, why is the famous split-window coupe more sought after today than a C4-era ZR1? It must be more than just rarity. After all, there were more split-window coupes built in 1 year than all 6 years combined of ZR1 production. So what makes a great collector car?
I think it's experience with that car. And those cars that we drove, and we have a split window, you could really relate to because you could understand them, and they were simple, and you could get under the hood and you could do anything, you know. And today, unfortunately, I think you open the hood and you close it because the average guy doesn't have a prayer. I mean, you don't have the tools, let alone the knowledge. You look at that split window coupe, and it's just sexy as can be. And you get in it and you drive it and you feel the same way. It's visceral. I don't know. I'm not the car guy. Your other guests are, but I just know from my experience as a boy, you know, you saw it, you loved it, and you could understand it and you could drive it.
Well, I think the Stingray, the let's not forget it was a transformational design, even though aerodynamically.
It was a brick.
Yeah, well, it had front-end lift.
It looked good.
Yeah.
It looked good aerodynamically.
Yeah, but on the track at about 140, it would start to lift the front end, which was a disaster, which Anna was too heavy, blah, 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 blah.
Who cares?
Yeah, but it's one of the
drop-dead gorgeous.
Yeah, one of the all-time great car designs, which sprung from my favorite all-time concept car of all time, the original Stingray.
Right.
Which was a race car first.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Which Ed Welborn has restored. It's just magnificent.
And when you see Ed drive it, he's got the biggest smile on his face, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That car's beautiful.
So, Mark, what makes a good collector car?
Whew.
You've got a few yourself.
I think it's looks, drivability. There's an element of rarity.
Yeah.
There's also a little bit of badge envy. I mean, I've been very lucky and driven a Maserati 300S, raced a Maserati 300S for nearly 10 years. And that's a better car in every regard than the Testarossa Ferrari. But, you know, a really good 300S just sold for, I think, $5.8 million US. A really good Testarossa is twice that money. You know, the badge on the front helps. It was funny, I was at Geneva and they were celebrating 50 years of the E-Type. And of course, you know, the E-Type was the best looking car on the stand. But, you know, E-Types are still relatively affordable. And that's mainly, I think, because they built so many of them. But, you know, if you've got a lightweight E-Type, one of, I think they built 13.
Yeah.
It's a race car. You know, that's $1-2 million car nowadays.
Yeah, I think the other component, which is hard to quantify, is emotionally compelling. Whatever the car, whatever the badge, it was an emotionally compelling car of its day or whatever, like the Stingray was, and the antidote for the Stingray, the 289 Cobra. I mean, emotionally compelling. The Testarossa was just, you know, I've heard that about the Maserati. Yeah, the Maserati is a great, better car, but the Testarossa is just this unbelievably wild-looking.
Yeah.
What Italian designers were doing in the 50s still blows my mind to this day. What they were doing, they were just right on a different planet.
And all handmade. I mean, hand-hammered panels.
Yeah.
I was at the Lambo Museum on Saturday. I mean, a Miura still looks like...
Yeah.
Oh, you know, can you imagine in 1966 seeing that car? It'd just knock your socks off. I mean,
I'll never forget. General Motors had one.
A Miura.
A Miura for evaluation. And we had it for a few days. And it had the tires of that era on it. I mean, American tires. It had...
bias ply.
Yeah. And, and we were standing around looking at it and driving, and it's just off the top of my head. I was fairly young. I said, going pretty fast. These tires don't look like this. So this is not a bright idea. But yeah, the Miura is just sensational in it.
Okay, George wants to know, how many gears is too much?
What do we have now? We have 8-speed automatics coming.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, fairly run-of-the-mill cars very shortly are going to have 8-speed automatics.
If you have to shift the gears yourself, probably about 6 is as many as you want to think about. But with an automatic, it ultimately doesn't matter if it's, a good 8-speed, like in the Lexus, for instance. I mean, you don't even notice the gears are changing.
Right.
So, you know, they're doing it for one reason, and that's fuel economy. But, I sometimes get a bit confused. You've got a 6-speed manual. You go, well, do I really need to use some of the... I mean, 5th and 6th are almost redundant if you're driving hard.
I like taking younger enthusiasts and having them see a 3 on the tree for the first time.
They
just like, what is that? It's got a clutch pedal, but it's got the thing up on the column.
They do. They freak out.
Yeah.
David, we got one for you. Jim from McLean wants to know, how have the rise in collector car prices over the last 30 years or so affected car museums getting people to donate cars or buying them? Has the increase in prices really affected?
No, I don't think so. I think in philanthropy in general,
except for this last year, philanthropy has always increased every year in spite of economic downturns. 2010 was the exception. We don't have any issue with people willingness to give us cars, with meaning price is not a consideration. Obviously, if it's more expensive, they get a bigger tax deduction. But that doesn't seem to be their primary motivation. People love their cars, as we've been talking about. And one of the compelling things we say is, John, you may have 10 collector cars and you're going to give them to your family, but there's one that you don't want its fate to be unknown, right? And to give it to a museum where it's going to be cared for and you know it, that's that emotional connection. And that's the way I think we can continue to get donations of automobiles. So I don't think it's really that big a concern.
Very interesting. Here's one for you, Mark, from George. He wants to know, do people in the U.K., I guess you're getting this question because of your accent, do people in the U.K. and Ireland love the Vauxhall brand so much that GM would hurt itself if they killed off the brand and just sold everything under the Opel brand?
I think they would. I mean, that's why they've kept it. I mean, Brits, for some reason, Brits seem to think that Vauxhalls are British cars. I mean, obviously they're German cars, but the money goes back to the US. But, you know, the brand's been, Vauxhall's been around since, basically the turn of the previous century. And, you know, it has a lot of credibility over there. I'm trying to think of some other brands that only exist in certain countries. It's kind of, maybe Holden. Holden's one
these days. But, I mean, you know, you used to have Roots and who else am I thinking
of? Well, Rover's the obvious one that disappeared.
Yeah, right. You know, but no, the Chinese have got that now.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Rowe.
Right. Glenn E. wants to know, how many Fiat dealers do you think Chrysler will end up with by the end of the year? Was this a mistake by Chrysler to require separate showrooms for Fiat?
Ooh.
I guess we could add right now, they're off to a slow start. They are behind schedule Fiat dealership.
What did I say? I said it on this show, and I said on the website that the 500 launch is going to be problematic. I think requiring dealers to have separate showrooms at this early stage is probably a mistake.
I think it is. I mean,
they need to get these cars out. They need people to, you know.
And there's a nice element of surprise. If you walk into a Chrysler dealership and you see the Fiat 500, they haven't got anything like that. You might go, oh, that's cool. But if people don't even really... The other thing about Fiat, you know, everybody goes, oh, fix it again, Tony. That's people of our ages. Kids, you know, 20-year-old kids have no idea about that reputation. And again, walk into a Chrysler dealership, it's cool, it's not that expensive. You could sell a few, but if it's a Fiat dealership, Fiat means virtually nothing to people who are in their 20s.
Good point. Steve wants to know, why doesn't the auto industry use some of their billions spent in R&D to develop a new fuel that's affordable and clean burning to eliminate government regulation? And he goes on a little bit, but I would say the auto industry doesn't know about fuel. They know about cars. I mean, they have experts that know how to burn fuel. They don't know how to make the stuff.
Well, people are working on fuel right now.
At the car companies.
Well, no, but I mean for the car companies. I mean, right. Advanced Fuels, Cascada, all that stuff.
Right.
You know.
So. Yeah. I would just say that, you know, stick to what you know, and the car companies know cars. I guarantee if they started to try to make fuel, it would be a disaster.
Well, Mercedes made their own fuel in the 30s for their Formula One cars, wasn't it corrosive and lethal?
It was methanol mixed with acetone, benzene, and all sorts of other stuff.
Yeah, and when they'd refuel them, the mechanics would just about fall over.
Well, remember in F1, you know, back in the 80s, they got this.
They used toluene. I mean, it was. I used to run a pre-war English race car running a really high compression, and the only way my dad could stop the pistons falling apart was to put toluene in there, and that's what they were using, and it's highly carcinogenic, and very evil
and,
stuff.
And we should add, just for those who don't know, toluene is one of the T's in TNT.
Yeah. And so, yeah, the Mercedes custom brewed their things for their Formula One cars, which is wild. Great breakers.
Hey, Ben, we got some phone calls coming in. Let's bring one in here.
This is Jeff W. from Albany, New York. I was just wondering if there has been any additional info about when or if Bob Bless will be returning to GM in a more formal consultative role. And second question is, would he really want the job? Maybe just to prevent Lieutenant Dan from undoing his progress, I guess. Thanks.
We have not had a confirmation.
This is Jeff.
Yeah, no, we have not had a confirmation that Bob will be a consultant. He wouldn't be going back there to work. He would just be a consultant. But look, you know, Bob Blutz does not want to just give up on this industry. So if they offer it to him, I'm sure he'll take it.
He's still an impressive guy. He's one of the few really well-rounded people in the industry who's done sales and marketing, knows product, got the background on the history and stuff. You know, he's one of the few, and he's one of the few people who says anything interesting. Oops, didn't say that.
Ben, let's bring in another call here.
Hi, this is Jonathan Brown out in Old Japan, New Jersey. This question is for the gentleman who has the Le Mans experience. Any possibility that Fiat, Chrysler, and maybe even Alfa Romeo one time in the near future have a show there? The history of Alfa Romeo and Fiat and Chrysler would be very exciting. So hope
the show where
it's
Le Mans?
A future possibility.
No, I think he means Le Mans.
Le Mans.
So is that for me?
Yeah, I think it was. But you're talking about the American experience, and I'm not sure Fiat and Lancia are part of the American experience.
Not really. No.
Ding ding ding.
No, I agree.
Let's see what else we got here. Bob McElroy, who's Bob McElroy, says, am I the only person that would like a light color interior other than black on performance vehicles like the Cadillac V, Kia Optima, SX Turbo, Pontiac G8, or Focus Platinum? I'm with this guy. I mean, these days it seems all you get in cars is black and beige. That's it.
If you notice the Focus, you go to the Ford website and you build a Focus, you can order two packages in the titanium Focus. One has a heavy dose of red inserts throughout, and the other has white inserts. So, yeah, that's a good point.
Look, you know, I think if you look at some of the great cars in history, or even great eras in cars, they did fantastic interiors, all different kinds of materials and colors and selection. And like I said, this guy's right. Today you get black or beige.
I loved the, in the original TT Audi, the baseball mitt leather.
Yeah.
It was fantastic.
That was terrific. Yeah. In fact, Volvo went with that kind of a look for a while,
with
big, thick leather stitching, not thread stitching, but leather stitching, like a baseball glove.
But it's interesting when you look in on European cars, for instance, there's a lot more color and trim possibilities in Europe. And they're very conservative when they bring the cars here in terms of colors and interiors.
I think it's a possibility or an opportunity to sell up. You can charge people for that sort of thing. So Miradart wants to know, will the selling of Spyker help Saab focus on rebuilding the brand, or was it totally a play for cash?
Gov, that's a difficult one. I think it was a play for cash. Actually, Victor Muller, who was Spyker and his Saab, he's an impressive guy, actually. Again, he's a bit like Lutz. But I think fundamentally he's a wheeler dealer. That's what he is. He sees a deal, and Saab was almost too good a deal to walk away from. And it's one of those things. It's like, can he keep it going long enough to get some sales volume back and then offload it to somebody else, probably the Chinese or somebody with a boatload of money who turns him, you know, a monster profit. I mean, that's what I think he's looking at. And maybe the reason for getting rid of Spyker was just to generate some cash. You know, he could argue, well, it's just to focus on the business. But I tend to think cash flow is kind of important in a car company.
Yeah, but my read is that was a play for cash for Victor Muller, not for Saab, because, you know, reportedly he got $21 million for it. And, I mean, Saab can burn through that in an afternoon. $21 million isn't going to do anything for a big car company. So I saw that as Victor needed some money, you know, sold it off. Now he can say, yeah, I'm focusing totally on Saab. I agree with you. I think he's a cool guy. I really want to see him succeed. I hope he can. I think he's got nothing but an uphill fight, though.
Oh, it's really difficult. I mean, this business, you know, the car business, people just forget how it burns through cash like you cannot believe. You know, I was talking about Tesla the other day, and they've got, you know, $700 million to outfit their factory, and we're thinking, well, it's not a lot, you know.
No.
Right. Not when you see those big, giant machines you have to use, you know, that cost $25 million a
No, that's exactly
pot,
right. And that's my fear for Saab is it needs to be spending billions right now on the next generation of product.
Yeah.
So
I'll tell you what's funny. I was looking at Aston at the Geneva show, and they've got yet another version of the DB9. And there's the perfect example of a company. Under Ford, they had the money to develop architectures and cars, and now all Betts is doing is recycling the same stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, you go, well, hang on a sec, where's the new cars? And I don't think there's the money there to produce new cars. And if you don't produce new cars, you're screwed, because that's what sells ultimately.
That's exactly right. Hey, Ben, I see we got one more phone call there. Let's bring it in.
Hi, Walt. I mean, I enjoyed watching the online TV on the internet today. I have a question. I have some significant Formula One F1 models made by Andy Matthews. And since F1 is not popular in the United States, I was wondering where the market would these possibly sell in. Could you kindly let me know?
Have you heard these models? Andy Matthews?
Yeah,
is that
they're
what
nice. They're really cool. Yeah.
They are.
Should sell them in England.
But that's why you have the internet. I mean, yeah. it's a great thing about, I mean, you know, Craigslist or eBay.
Whatever, yeah. Sell them over there.
Well, look, guys, we're at the top of the hour here. This is probably a good time to wrap it all up. But David Madeira, thanks so much for Skyping in from Tacoma, Washington, and bringing us up to speed on the LeMay. I said I wasn't going to say museum, but I don't know what else to call it.
I haven't figured it out yet either, John. So thanks for the opportunity. And any one of you three, come on out anytime. I'd be happy to show you around.
That's way cool. Thanks for the offer.
And thanks a lot.
Mark Gillies, thanks for stopping in here. Been great having you.
Yeah, it's fun.
It's good to have you, Mark.
It's good. And Peter, always good being with you.
Glad to be here.
Every time. So thanks, folks. Remember that you can always friend us on Facebook at facebook.com/OutOfLineDetroit or follow us at twitter.com/OutOfLine. You can follow Peter at autoextremist.com or on Twitter at twitter.com/autoextremist. And that's the other thing. David, are you still there? Yeah, you're still there.
Yes, sir.
How do people find anything about LeMay?
Well, they can just Google it, but lemaymuseum.org.
Okay, so yeah, I see you used the word museum in there.
I have to.
Mark, anything that you want to push here?
No, not really.
Okay. You should say hi to Roaster Jack, greatnoroco.com, and Scotty in Cleveland, of course.
You know, check out Roundabout. They're going to be talking all about the Geneva show, and they say they're going to cover 60 cars in 90 minutes. And thanks, everybody, for tuning in. It's been great having you. We'll be back here again next week.
And Simon, good night.
Visit our website, outoflinedetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with Out of Line Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Out of Line Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at AutolineDetroit.tv.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence, and by Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more.